First case of the morning, United States versus Graylin White et al. Mr. Van Cleve.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chad Van Cleve. I have the privilege of being a court-appointed counsel for Mr. Graylin Leon White. This case is about a statute that for 19 years was treated as a true recidivist statute, the court in Deal changed that in this circuit. Supreme Court affirmed, and since that time, this case has been treated as something other than the true recidivist statute that it is. We've argued this foreclosed issue with the intention of preserving it for further appeal. We also, in this case, had an insufficiency of the evidence issue as to the interstate commerce nexus with regard to the robberies as alleged. The government, in its one opportunity to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, failed to offer any evidence that the robberies alleged in the indictment affected interstate commerce. It went to great lengths to put on testimony of expert witnesses that cocaine and marijuana had an effect on interstate commerce, but it did not put on any evidence as to whether the robberies charged in the case affected interstate commerce. And finally, since the submission of our briefing in this case, U.S. Supreme Court made its ruling in Allen, holding that any fact which increases a mandatory minimum sentence for a crime must be proved by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, cannot be found by a judge on preponderance of the evidence standard. In this case, Mr. White was charged with two counts of 924C under 1A2, which had a statutory mandatory minimum of 7 years. On the first count, he was found guilty, but there was no finding of brandishing the weapon, and so it was sentenced to 5 years on that count. On the count three, there was a finding of guilt under that same statute. There was a brandishing finding by the jury, but then subsequently the court sentenced under an entirely different statutory provision, 924C1C, of which Mr. White was not charged in the indictment and which the jury did not find him guilty. Section C1C carries a mandatory minimum 25-year consecutive sentence. Not being charged under that statute, not being on notice that he was alleged to have violated that statute, not being found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt by the jury, the maximum sentence that Mr. White could have received under the circumstances was 7 years. With that finding of brandishing, a 7-year sentence would have been the appropriate sentence, rather than 5 years. Allen applies makes the need to prove a factor that raises a standard a statutory mandatory minimum applicable to 924C cases. And we would ask the court to take those things into consideration. Be glad to answer any questions you might have as to any of those issues.
All right. You done? All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Calhoun.
May it please the court. Excuse me. My name is Alex Calhoun. I represent Mr. Davian Roberts in this case, counsel. Judge, as I was preparing the brief on this case, or preparing the for oral argument, I recognize that there is a sizable number of judges on this court that have a dispute with the traditional manner in which this court addresses Hobbs Act prosecutions under the Commerce Clause. And so while the brief itself relates to the I'm going to call it the traditional approach, U.S. versus Robinson, I guess, announces that approach. I'd like to focus oral argument on perhaps saying this is the opportunity for the court to address the concerns about whether it's appropriate under the traditional approach to look at Hobbs Act prosecutions under the aggregation principles that this court has traditionally used. The court needs to be aware that the case I'm referring to is McFarland versus U.S. There's a 8 judges dissented in an en banc decision on that, urging that because of a change in Supreme Court case law in the past decade, that it's time to reevaluate the way in which the courts analyze Hobbs Act prosecutions under the Commerce Clause. That cases that we're talking about here is U.S. versus Lopez, which is the gun in schools case, and U.S. versus Morrison, which is the violence against women cases. In Lopez in particular, the Supreme Court first announced analytical approach to looking at Commerce Clause issues, that the Congress has three basic focuses of the Commerce Clause.
And is there a difference here? I mean, affecting commerce and in commerce? I mean, this only has to be in commerce, right?
Well, what?
I mean, it's clearly that whenever you have a, I mean, we've made clear in the Collins case that if you have a robbery off a business that's in interstate commerce, then you've satisfied that requirement. Here, drug business is always in interstate commerce, as long as it's drug money and drugs involved in it, and maybe a few other.
Well, let me suggest this, Judge. Collins, I believe, is in the...
My question is, why isn't a drug business, this drug operation, same as Denny's would have been if it had been robbed in the Collins case?
Well, again, following Collins and the McFarland decision, I think, that Judge, you joined the McFarland dissent. McFarland takes a different view of that, in that the focus of the Hobbs Act is upon not upon protecting the drug business, it's upon the robberies. And that's what robberies, and then the focus of McFarland is that robberies are not part of commerce in the way that we've traditionally viewed commerce under the Wickard versus Filburn conception. So McFarland, drawing upon what Lopez and Morrison...
What were the facts in McFarland?
McFarland, and that's good you ask that, Judge, because they're actually somewhat indistinguishable from drug. It's not a significant decision. McFarland involved serial robbery of several, I think, convenience stores.
Oh, yeah, right.
And as the court made much, or the dissent made much hay over the fact that all these stores dealt with products that traveled interstate commerce. And which is important because if products travel interstate commerce across the United States or across the world, it makes a difference whether cocaine itself is from Colombia or my milk is from California. It's the same theoretical principle there that if it travels from interstate commerce, that's how we've been traditionally using the Commerce Clause to extend jurisdiction to these extraordinarily local matters. What McFarland says, drawing upon Lopez and Morrison, is that we need to reformulate the focus and see whether or not this is actually an economic concern. And what McFarland basically says is that robbery, particularly local robberies, is not the type of concern that Congress had in enacting the Hobbs Act, and that given the Supreme Court's focus in Lopez and Morrison on basically restricting the scope of the Commerce Clause to more of a rational...
But that was not an issue in Collins, was it?
Well, Collins, I believe, was a robbery of an individual, Judge. And again, that is a theoretical limiting principle of the Hobbs Act, is a robbery of an individual.
Question. I mean, I thought in Collins was that the employee was not in the restaurant. If he'd been robbed in the restaurant as a cashier and they'd robbed Denny's money, that would have been the end of it. That would have established commerce.
Possible, Judge. I'm not trying to dodge the issue, but I think the point is that McFarland will change that analysis there. Under the old Wickard versus Filburn approach, if you go into a restaurant and rob the restaurant, yes, that will make Hobbs Act prosecution under the old pre-Lopez, pre-Morrison, non-McFarland view of the law. What we're arguing here is that given McFarland is saying this court needs to reevaluate how we approach this here, that this is the time to reevaluate, and whether certain actions which are not deemed within the Lopez-Morrison view of what commerce is need to be regarded as local, purely local, not federal concerns. Again, robbery of a local store, even if the items within the local store themselves are transnational, and they basically are, Judge, we have to understand that in the modern United States, everything comes from somewhere else, that there needs to be a reevaluation, because otherwise anything can be a federal concern. And I believe the whole point of McFarland and any other people that may be viewing this issue here is that it's sort of an absurd result to think that I could be prosecuted when I return to Austin for shoplifting a McElhenney's Tabasco sauce and then clobbering the store security officer. That's intuitively something wrong with that. And so
we would need, wouldn't we, to take this in bank if we were to reevaluate what our in bank court did in McFarland?
Judge, the court has never addressed the impact of McFarland upon the case. The panel here can say, look, we never addressed Morrison and Lopez. We're going to do it right now, and the in bank court will probably need to reevaluate it. But I think you have the ability to do so because there's been a change in law that's not been addressed.
Great. Thank you, sir. Gay?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to begin, I guess, starting with the Hobbs Act. Here, as Judge Jolly recognized, this court's jurisprudence in the area of interstate nexus relating to drug trafficking, this is a regulated market where this court has consistently held that affecting by robbery drug trafficking activities has an effect on interstate commerce. It is simply, we started with McFarland through Hicks, Box, Villafranca. Bailey is an excellent opinion. Those are all cited in our brief, which specifically mirrors the facts of our case. Here, there is no challenge to the fact that the robberies took place, that these were drug traffickers, and that money and drugs were stolen. And therefore, the nexus.
The market is federally specifically regulated.
Beg your pardon?
And that market is regulated by federal law.
Exactly. And what's interesting is if you go to McFarland or any of the subsequent cases that follow, they essentially carve out regulated markets such as drugs, guns, all those sorts of things from their analysis. And so McFarland, of course, sort of stands by itself because it's a convenience store set of cases. But in fact, it's interesting the exact language that the court uses. It says, thus putting aside robberies as part of an effort to regulate particular interstate markets such as guns, drugs, or organized crime syndicates, a local robbery spree can be within Congress's power only if by itself it has a substantial effect. It recognizes from the beginning that this is an entirely different set of facts when we involve robberies involving organized crime such as drug trafficking or other regulated markets. And the fact that it is an illegal activity doesn't make any difference, of course.
Well, I mean, those convenience stores independently and apart from each other were not obviously in interstate commerce. They were doing strictly local business, both their products locally and so on.
That's what the whole debate there was about. Here, since we have this regulated activity, the effect on commerce that needs to be shown is only slight. And this court has consistently recognized, in fact, I think it's settled, that robberies, such as the one in this case, do, by their nature, affect interstate commerce. When you have foreign sources of, it's an interstate market, number one, and the drugs that are sold within that market and the proceeds that travel from those sales clearly affect the interstate market.
Well, the whole, as I understand it, the whole federal criminal power over drug activities is allowed only because it stems from the commerce power, doesn't it?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And so that's where, essentially, if we go back to the very beginning, and I think that legislative history is discussed in several of the cases, that this has always been an area of where regulation has been appropriate. And so the scheme is in place. This court's precedent is very clear. I don't believe this is the case to invite a reconsideration of this court's analysis under the Commerce Clause. I do believe that at this point...
Don't most circuits have some modification of the Collins rule of some sort about the application of the Hobbs Act to individual robberies?
Outside of the context of drug cases, I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Have any of those cases ever dealt with the drug robbery that have held that it is not in interstate commerce and subject to the Hobbs Act prosecution?
Not one that I have seen. In this circuit alone, there are five published cases spanning the last decade or
so. But they really don't deal with Collins, do they?
Not directly.
None of them address the Collins issue.
Not directly. But I don't believe that there's anything that would undermine this panel's reliance on that whole body of case law. It certainly seems at this point to be a settled doctrine within the circuit. I'd like to turn to briefly the discussion of the Supreme Court's opinion in the Alene case and whether it has any effect. In fact, in this circumstance, the recidivist portion of 924C that got Mr. White the 25-year sentence, this is an Almendores-Torres issue. In fact, in the Alene opinion and in the footnote one of that opinion, they specifically state that they're setting aside and they're not addressing whether Almendores-Torres should be overruled. It clearly hasn't been overruled. And so following from Apprendi, basically, that when you have a recidivist-based enhancement as opposed to an element or a fact that increases the minimum mandatory, there is no issue. That case is simply not affecting the application of the 25-year mandatory minimum in under these facts. And I did find one published opinion that just came out from the Sixth Circuit, a case called United States versus Mack, and at 729-594, which directly speaks to this issue and follows exactly the same reasoning that I just gave you, and that is that this is really an Almendores-Torres issue. It's really not one of the – when they say that a fact that increases either the statutory maximum or the mandatory minimum, a recidivist enhancement is not one of those facts that has to be pled and proved to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And so that issue, I think, is clearly settled. All right. If there are no other issues, yes?
On the the restitution issue, does the government concede that point?
Actually, it's a very interesting issue, and as we argued in our brief, that there is a temporal sort of ambiguity here because we offered proof, and there was proof, that we had robberies that occurred a mere 5 days apart.
Why isn't that a stretch, Mr. Kay?
At the end of our argument, however, we say that if the court finds that if they are not temporally close enough.
I still say, why isn't that a stretch? I mean, the point where you got a robbery occurring, you know, later, and the government wants to.
Well, we cited
put it in the draft, you know, as in wind suction of these other counts, so it
got included, Your Honor. However, as we pointed out in the brief, and I think it's a fair argument, that there is some room where this court has recognized, despite Huey.
That's why they have you argue these things. You very adept at dealing with these creative, these nuanced.
It is, number one, it's a plain error issue. I don't believe, and so at the end of the day, essentially, to be quite frank, we had an organized scheme involving robberies of drug dealers. These individuals worked the circuit there. This one robbery occurred 5 days. The 21st was the one, the 26th, I believe, was the second one, the Let's See robbery. And to link those together temporally, it's not as if they were a year apart or some substantial portion of time. I would argue under a plain error standard of review that this inclusion, because of the similarity of the offenses, the scheme, the nature, and the temporal time frame involved, that it did not affect the defendant's substantial rights.
Well, even if it did, it wouldn't meet the fourth prong because it wouldn't be something that would be deemed so unfair or affect the reputation of the courts. We could almost pretermit the third prong and get to the fourth, couldn't we?
The fourth prong is always there, and I tend to agree with you, Judge Smith.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked. All right.
If there are no further questions, I'll yield back my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gay. As always, we appreciate your rebuttal, Mr. Van Cleve.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the only issue that would tag a true rebuttal issue is the Almendorez-Torres and Apprendi issue with regard to the Alleyne case. If in the Alleyne case he was charged under 924C(a)(i), and it was inappropriate to enhance his sentence 2 more years for 924C(a)(i), I think it's an argument a fortiori that to bump to an entirely different subsection of the statute and enhance by 25 years is just that much more inappropriate. It's a separate statute with which he was not charged. He was not found guilty under that particular statute. I think if this were just a sentencing guideline enhancement, would have been totally appropriate. It's a statutory enhancement, does increase the mandatory minimum. Alleyne applies the holding of Apprendi to 924C cases, and we do believe it's required that this had been found by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Calhoun, any further words?
With the court's permission, I will seal the time back in the court.
All right. Thank you. We recognize Mr. Van Cleve and Mr. Calhoun that you're court appointed, and our entire court, in addition to this panel, appreciates our court appointed counsel, both your work with the brief and coming to argue the case. Thank you. All right. Thank you. The case will be.